I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Z-Man, the blogger. We met at the American Renaissance Conference, and I thought I would get a little bit better acquainted with him and also introduce him to my readership and listenership. So, Z-Man, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, what brought you to the American Renaissance Conference?
Well, I just kind of felt it's a strange thing, really. I've known about it for a long time. As I told Jared Taylor, my sense was all along that it was basically just a bunch of old gray-haired guys complaining about the blacks and the Jews and how the 50s were great, and that's fine, but that's not really my scene. So I never really thought it was, I don't know, it just didn't seem like it was a place for me. But I don't know. There's just so much energy the last couple years. And I thought, well, you know what? I could be wrong. And why don't I just sign up and go and see? Because I've been a fan of John Derbyshire for, 20 years. And I thought, you know, he's getting a little long in the tooth. So if I'm going to – I've never met him. I've corresponded with him for a very long time. And I thought, well, why don't I make a – I'll get that out of it. I'll ready to introduce myself and maybe buy the man a drink and enjoy his company a little bit. So I didn't really go there with any expectations other than it just kind of felt like something was happening, and I wanted to see, and I was blown away by it, frankly. I had such a good time. It was much younger, much more exciting. It was great to be in an atmosphere where you could speak your mind without having to worry about someone standing behind you, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. It's really nice to be around a lot of people who understand these issues and who are not going to jump down your throat about dissident thoughts. So how old are you exactly?
I am 50.
You're 50. Okay. And the crowd there was significantly younger than the last time I was at AMREN, which was 2008. The first AMREN I was at was 2002, then 2006, then 2008. So this is my fourth. And the average age, the number of gray heads in the room has definitely declined pretty dramatically in the last few years. And there was a time, I guess, when you could say that it was sort of like going to church or the opera. It was an older generation, basically very, very, very nostalgic about the past. But something really has changed in the culture today. And this movement is growing. How did you come to this movement?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a question that everybody was asking each other at AMREN. That's one of the things that was kind of funny in a way. You'd talk to someone, you get to know them a few minutes, and then the first thing they'd say is, "Well, how did you get here?" And it didn't mean, did you drive? How did you get, your emotional trip, your intellectual trip? And there's two pieces to that, I think. There's an intellectual part and there's an emotional part. You know, for me, I grew up in the South, so I was always race aware, a race realist. You really can't grow up in the South and not be aware of these things. But, I'm a man of my age, too, and I've moved all over the place. So I kind of learned to just kind of keep that to myself and not organize my life accordingly, but not, not talk about it. But other issues when it comes to politics and immigration, I was probably slow on the draw when it comes to immigration. It was actually foreign-born friends a decade ago sort of turned me on to the lunacy of open borders. I never thought about it too much, but these were guys whose families came over in the 60s and 70s, and they were adamant. I mean, some of the more rigorous immigration patriots are people who came here 30 years ago legally. They're fanatics about it. It's a strange phenomenon, but some issues I was a little slow to things, but I confined myself. I used to confine myself to the comment sections of conventional right-wing political sites and just criticize them from sort of a paleocon perspective or an old right perspective, because I thought that's all it was going to be. That was as good as I could get. Our politics were so polluted and so screwed up that it was a question of, you know, we're driving over the cliff. Are we going to go fast? Are we going to go slow? Am I going to enjoy the ride? You know, there was never any question about what was going to happen. And I guess a few years ago, I decided, you know, this doesn't have to be this way. And so I started a blog and I started writing my thoughts on things. And surprisingly, I got an audience. And, you know, it's one of, I think, you know, it's kind of like you open a door and you walk through it. You know, I was already, you know, a lot of doors out of the room, but I hadn't gone to those other doors. And I just finally said, why not? And, you know, I think, you know, in my case, I was always kind of here. It's just I didn't realize here was here. It sounds like a crazy thing to say.
I hear that a lot from people. They realize that it's more a feeling of waking up to what you've always already been than arriving at some new position in a lot of cases.
I know a lot of guys in this thing will they're very much against adventurism in foreign policy. And I've largely always been down with that, but my view has always been, well, nothing I can do about it. No one's going to listen to me. This is the nature of empires. And I just hope they make good television out of it. And so, I wouldn't say anything about it. I would keep my mouth shut. But then you find out, geez, you know, there's a lot of people who think that this is insane. And it's surprising, I think. And that seems to be what's happening. I know that's that energy I was talking about, it is that more and more people are finding out that there's more and more people who hold these ideas.
Yeah, we're not alone. We're not the crazy ones.
Yeah, exactly that. It's you know, we've all been Jack Nicholson in the cuckoo's nest, and you know, somebody, you know, it's these old guys, you know, the Jerry Taylors, the John Derbyshires, even going back further, you know, guys like Sobran and Sam Francis, you know, they're the Indian who threw the water fountain through the window and let us all out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I knew Sam Francis. I met Sobran on a couple of occasions and read him for years. I give them a lot of credit. They did lay a lot of the foundations of what's happening today. And Jared Taylor, of course, is still with us, thank goodness, and I hope he will be with us for a much longer time. So who are some of the writers and the magazines, webzines, platforms who were formative influences on how you came to your present thinking? And would you describe yourself as a white nationalist or a somewhat edgy Republican or a libertarian? How would you characterize your thinking, and how did you get here?
Well, the label part I struggle with, because James Fulford, I think it's how his name at VDair, started giving me the business about I once wrote that white nationalism is silly, and the reason is the label silly, and white nationalism is a label that conjures images of guys playing dress up, running around in the woods, saluting each other. And, you know, we shouldn't adopt a label like that. That was my point. And he didn't disagree, but I don't think he agreed with me. But we have to be careful with these labels, because white nationalist comes with baggage. And baggage that I don't want to carry around. You know, that the mistakes of the past are not mistakes I want to drag around with me. But that's true of you know, a big, if you say, well, you're pro-white. Well, that's okay. That's not a bad thing. You know, alt-right, that's another term that's got a lot of connotations that I'm not sure that – I don't even think everybody agrees with what alt-right means. So I settle on dissident right, and I drill down from there and say I'm a biological realist. And I've got a sort of an empirical mind. I come at some of these subjects quantitatively. I'm a guy who used to read all the quantitative bloggers, all the HBD guys. I've been reading these guys for years. So that's in my wheelhouse. And, you know, the paleocons were certainly guys that I always gravitated to. By nature, I'm a bit of a populist, I think, which is strange given that I'm probably one of the more well-read people that you'd ever run into. I mean, I have probably in my home, I bet you I have 2,000 books that I've, these are the books I've read that I kept that I didn't give away. You know, I'm a very well-read guy, but at the same time, I'm much more comfortable around people who are not very well-read. I have more confidence in the average American than I do in our educated and cognitive elites. But, you know, and of course, that has to do with growing up in the South, growing up poor. So, you know, I'm populist, a bit of a Southern populist. I've always kind of rejected libertarianism just as – and blank slateism in general. People are not moist machines. We're all different. We're products of our evolutionary past. I start with dissonant right. I get to biological realism. And then after that, I start to kind of drift off, as you can tell, because – I've thought about it, but I haven't really settled on any set of labels that really work for me. I will say this, that is, being pro-white or pro-white people or pro-European, that's an important definition. I think, you know, you can't be in this thing if that's not where you are, and that's certainly where I am. Beyond that, I think there's probably, you know, economics I don't care about that much. Culture items I do write about a fair amount, but you know, there can be plenty of disagreements on that kind of stuff, culture issues, economic issues, social issues. But I think the core is that you got to be pro your team. You know, Vox Dei puts it best. You know, our skin is our uniform.
Yeah, that's right. We take our own side in a fight, and the world's full of ethnic struggles right now.
There's no question about that. You know, that, and I live in Baltimore, so you can't help but be a race realist. Everybody's a race realist. The most liberal person is a race realist. Black people are race realists. Everybody's a race realist. And if you want to see the future, you come to a place like this, because this is what a majority minority community looks like. It's everybody is in their own camp, and everybody takes their own side.
Mm-hmm. Except for white people. We have to be the universal people. We have to look out for everybody but ourselves, because that's what makes us feel high-minded and good about ourselves.
It's a suicidal altruism.
Yeah, yeah. So who are some of the writers and thinkers who have had the most influence on your journey?
I tell you, the guy who was always the guy who kind of made me think that I'm not crazy was Steve Saylor. He's a quantitative guy. He does a lot of HBD stuff. And, you know, it was always the guy I could read and think, geez, there's at least one other smart person out there who knows the same stuff I do or knows it better in many cases. In terms of popular people who are still alive, I would say John Derbyshire was another guy that I always enjoyed. In the olden times, guys like Sobrin, of course, Sam Francis. I have always been, since I was a little kid, an H.L. Mencken fan. But people tell me that I have that same kind of disposition, and I think they might be right about that. You know, I can see the ridiculousness of my own team as well as everybody else's team. But I think in terms of, you know, my, I guess, intellectual framework as it is now, Oswald Spengler would certainly be a guy when it comes to history and the role of history and culture. I don't know if you've read my site, but I will do Spengler-esque sort of bits on the birth and life and death of cultures. In terms of theoretical stuff, certainly Spengler is a big influence. I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah, actually, that might be a really good post one day to put up.
Yeah, Spengler is a huge influence on a lot of our people. Mencken is, you know, usually today, if you find a Mencken fan, they're almost always going to be people who are close to us. Otherwise, he's just not read. He's not promoted by the conservative canon people anymore. He's not really read by anybody outside the right anymore, and so. You know, Mencken is one of those people that I kind of, when I'm looking at somebody's writings or their Facebook profile or something like that, if I see a Mencken reference, I'll sort of add that to the list of signs that they might be a sympathetic person. Spengler is definitely another person like that. I dare say there are very few people who read and talk about Spengler in earnest today who are not sort of in our sphere. H.P. Lovecraft, well, he's got a bit bigger an audience, I suppose, just in the fantasy and sci-fi world, but it's extraordinary the number of our people who are really into him, too. So that's always one of the things I look for.
Well, you know, it is funny in a way that, you know, if you look at well, there's a lot of signaling goes on, mm-hmm. too. And strangely enough, one of the ways in which we probably our team has gotten good at is in picking out these people and putting them on our Facebook profile or our Twitter handle or something like that in order to let people know that, you know, we're willing to color outside the lines. And which I think is a really important part. It's one of the things that I really took away from with Amren. I'm okay with, you know, disagreeing with someone on, you know, some of the touchy subjects, you know, who is white, you know, that's a touchy subject, right? Well, you can have a disagreement, but if you can have an unemotional and thoughtful disagreement about a hard subject, then you can have unemotional and thoughtful discussions about all kinds of other things too. And that's what was the vibe I had at Amren, is that everybody was there just to exchange ideas. Nobody was walking around saying, I'm the keeper of the one true faith and everyone else is a heretic. And that's an important part of what we've got going on, I think, is that smart people are being smart together and willing to be. I mean, there's no group of people who are more appreciative of human diversity and intellectual diversity than the dissident right now.
I would agree with that completely. We do have a much more intellectual, freewheeling culture, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's attracting young people to it, young, intellectually inclined people. The left is dead. The left is totally brain dead. It's not exciting at all, intellectually speaking. And I think the greatest intellectual and cultural radical energies are now on the right. And I'm really enjoying it. It's fun to be involved in this. It's not fun to be involved with leftist stuff, especially for a white guy. It's not fun to be. They're getting sick of the progressive stack. And, you know, I've met people, I've been contacted by people who are countercurrents readers today who voted for Hillary Clinton in the last election. They're evolving at an accelerated rate in the culture today. People are dramatically changing their thinking. And I think that they're coming in our direction because what we've got is so attractive and interesting. Now, there are some hot button issues, litmus test issues, you know, cranky, paranoiac, one-dimensional people who are kind of repulsive and will you know, thrust people back, you know, who are coming into it. But generally, I just think that we're going to outgrow these people and dilute these people out of the system by this influx of basically younger and more intellectually open people.
Yeah, I'm one of my themes is that, well, I have two kind of I'm like a lot of spurgy people in some regards, in that I'll get on some topic and I'll work it for, you know, a month or two, and, you know, a post or two a week. But, you know, there's two things that I've been on, especially since I was down at Amren. I were on my mind and it really confirmed something I suspected. And one is that for this thing to last, it has to be a cultural movement. It has to be broader. You know, I had dinner with a couple of guys, or some drinks, actually, not dinner, but on Friday night. They're musicians. They're doing alt-right music. That's what they were calling it, you know, and they have their own kind of, they're trying to weave some of the cultural themes that they read about into popular music for young kids. Well, that's a good thing. I mean, their music might be terrible, I don't know, but it's that kind of attitude that it, you know, we're not going to be just narrowly confined to a half a dozen political items. You know, it's not going to be a political movement. It has to be a cultural movement. Cultural movements are big ideas. And that spur and generate political ideas and political movements. But the other thing is, it has to be a positive identity. a negative identity. You know, I did a post the other day on a guy named Leonard Pitts, I think his name is. I've never heard of him. Some guy who comments on my blog is always talking about how this guy is the greatest black writer in America. So I went and looked him up, and I started reading his stuff, and it was all books about being black, books about dead people who are black, and that's all it is. You know, as John Derbyshire calls it, the blackity black. And you can't – black identity in America is all about black people's relationship to white people. If white people disappeared, black identity in America disappears with it, because everything about being a black person is related to this externality, this exogenous set of forces, the history of race relations, slavery, segregation, white attitudes, the magic of white privilege, that sort of thing. And that negative identity makes you a slave of other people, and it constrains you. And I think ultimately it's unappealing. So this thing has to be a positive identity. You know, these are the things that we are. This is what we stand for. This is the general ideas. And, you know, that works well with a cultural movement. You know, it's why the left has for three generations has been successful, even though most of what the left is a rant against nature. You know, is observably false. And yet it carries on from generation to generation because it brings with it music and fashion and all the cultural attributes, you know, and it draws a lot of people in, and it's able to draw new energy. You know, there's young – think about that the young guy who voted for Barack Obama. I mean, he feels like an idiot now, but, you know, the guy was at Ameren.
Julian yeah, Langness.
Yeah, you know – but, you know, he got into that whole thing because it felt exciting. You know, that's why he got into it. And our thing's got to have that same excitement. It's got to have that same energy. It's got to be broad in that, hey, you know, you're not really into the philosophical stuff, but you're into this other thing, or you're, you know, your other aspect of it. And, you know, that way it can be broad without being, with still having definition, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. When I was in France in 2001, I flew to France just after September 11, 2001, and I went to the Fête de Bleu Blanc Rouge, which is the big annual festival that the Front National would do. There were maybe 20 or 30,000 people who went to this festival. It was on the edges of Paris. And the thing that amazed me about it, I was there 2 days, is they had these huge circles surrounded by tents and pavilions, and there were people selling books, there were winemakers and cheesemakers, bookbinders, clothiers. There was an entire rightist subculture that was out on display, and that this was the connective tissue, the support mechanism, the thing that sustained people's identification with the National Front, even when they weren't going through an electoral cycle. And that, I think, is something that we need very, very much, because if it's just electoral politics, I would see this happen over and over again. Because we had such a culturally thin movement in America, the electoral races would become these all-consuming things. People would comment on them. They would follow them. They would invest themselves in them, even though they knew better than getting excited about Mitt Romney. They would still do it against all better judgment and instincts. And then at the end, they'd be totally, totally exhausted emotionally and spent and disappointed and cranky. And so then people would drop out of sight. Traffic would drop on the various websites, and then it would slowly build back up again. And the reason why that was happening is that we didn't have anything between elections to sustain us, except for complaining about the status quo, all the bad news of the day. And I think that as we build a real-world culture, that is going to be the thing that will sustain our ability to not just follow elections, but eventually contest for political power with other groups, because that's the end game that we have to look towards, is we'll have to try and gain political power. And It doesn't happen without a cultural matrix, though. And the cultural matrix has to be something thicker and more real and less ephemeral than internet interactions.
Well, that's what I think, back in the 80s, yeah, there's not a lot of benefits to getting old. But one of them is I actually remember stuff that happened before a lot of these young guys were born. And when I write about stuff like the 80s or the 90s, it's an interesting comments I get often from 20-somethings or 30-somethings who are thankful that, like, wow, I'll go look this up. I didn't realize that this was the antecedent. But anyway, putting that aside, I've been getting teased a lot because I keep mentioning my age. And I guess maybe that just happens as you hit 50. But and there's probably a bet as to how long it would have taken me to mention my age in this podcast. But I've got but back in the 80s, the Christian groups, the evangelicals, they were not wrong. They started figuring out that, hey, they needed to engage in politics, but they understood that, hey, if we get our guys in office, our guys, even though they, they're going to have to make all the compromises that politicians have to make, they're going to start from our camp instead of, starting in somebody else's camp and us hoping that they'll give us a little bit one, and come our way a little bit. They had that part right, but what they got wrong is that, they allowed themselves to be, consumed by the existing political culture. And that meant they became just another feature in the Republican Party. And the Republican Party accepted the moral framework of the left. They embraced all this stuff. They said, yes, absolutely, the blank slate is real. And yes, absolutely, racism is the worst possible sin. And yes, anti-Semitism, well, that's even worse than racism. And so inevitably, these Christians found themselves constrained by this moral framework that they entered into instead of imposing their moral framework on things. And then that's what we've got to, figure out is how do we establish this moral framework of our own where, these are the things. I don't know who I was talking to, but I don't remember now. But the way I liked saying it is, what are you going to be more concerned about in your neighborhood? Let's say you're middle class, suburban, white guy. Are you more concerned that the guy who moved in down the street is an anti-Semite or that he's a bank robber? Which one bothers you more? Well, clearly a bank robber, or he's a wife beater or a murderer or something like that. I mean, these are things you would care much more about. You could probably name 100 things that are more important to you in terms of, the person you would live next door in your neighborhood than being a, an anti-Semite or a racist or he doesn't like Koreans or something. Well, we know this instinctively. That's our revealed preference. We allow the left to impose a moral framework on us that's completely upside down. It says, no. If you find out that your neighbor down the street doesn't like, black people, well, you better call somebody. You call his boss. Let people know that this guy's a hate thinker. And we've got to kind of flip that around and, take the understanding that, we'll support our own. We'll support our guys, whether it's in politics or culturally. But at the same time, we're not going to be a part of something else, of the existing structure. We're not going to join the Republican Party or join the Democratic Party or wherever else. And I'm not really sure how you do that, but that's something I've been thinking about a lot, is that how do you grow a cultural movement and it doesn't get co-opted or corrupted? Because you can see that, you can see it's going to start happening. These guys from National Review are going to start declaring themselves alt-right next week and try and take things over.
Right. Well, whenever somebody talks about the danger of losing the alt-right brand, it's like, well, I just say, they're not going to be declaring themselves white nationalists next week. They're not going to try and steal that brand. The only reason why the alt-right is appealing is that it's vague enough for them to try and put their own content into it. But what you're saying is very important. It really boils down to the whole priority of metapolitics over politics. Metapolitics, the way I use it, has to do with your intellectual framework, your worldview, and also your community, if you have an organized community that sort of embodies a worldview. And those set the conditions for politics. And the reason why the right fails so much is they just think politics is about winning office, and they are just pikers when it comes to the metapolitical. And so they think they're really, really clever by accepting the premises of the enemies and then trying to use those fundamental premises to argue for their conclusions. And the enemy loves that because they know that in the end, premises will out, and that these people will be, they'll be either revealed to be hypocrites and people will disdain them, or they're going to be slowly dragged around to changing their thinking. They'll be getting those strange new respect awards from the New York Times eventually, and so forth. And that's, it's just childish. It's childish. I got this new book by Dinesh D'Souza, The Big Lie, and I have to say that this is the stupidest book I've ever read, and I've read thousands of books, and it could very well be the stupidest book ever written, because what he's trying to do is argue that Democrats are the real Nazis. You know, he pioneered, you know, Democrats are the real racists, and now he's trying to do Democrats are the real Nazis. And it's so childish because, again, the whole assumption is that we'll just allow the left to establish the parameters of debate and we'll just come up with some clever little hat trick to turn that around against them. They're the real fascists. They're the real racists. When the true revolution is to say, look, there's nothing wrong with racism. It's healthy. It's natural. It's normal. It's a feature of every successful society, every politically realistic movement. Fascism, well, you know, you can gainsay. I mean, you can criticize it here and there, but every functional society ends up being a little bit fascist when you get right down to it. They might just disguise it under different terms and pretend that they're super liberal, but they're really fascist. That's the true revolution, is just to overthrow their value system and set up a different value system. And the right, though, is slavishly, mentally fettered to the left-wing value system. They're singing in their chains. Every time I look at something like National Review or crack open something by Dinesh D'Souza, I just see these people in their left forged mental manacles singing in their chains and thinking they're so damn clever, and that this time somehow the Dems are the real racists or the Dems are the real fascist thing is going to work, which it just never seems to work.
That's, I think, it's funny. I mean, politically, you know, I came alive in the 80s, you know, as a teenager, and Reagan, you know, part of what I kind of had a smile when I saw these Generation Z 20-year-olds, college kids at Ameren, and, you know, they're all just excited by Trump. And I remember being that, I remember thinking that in the 1980s, that this is it, you know, that all that nonsense from the 60s and 70s, well, now we're going to start to roll it back. It was a big mistake. Everybody understands it. That's why Reagan was so popular. And it was just a matter of time. And then, you know, the Bush years, you know, kind of woke me up to the fact that, no, that was just kind of a respite. And the forces of darkness have rallied, and we're in big trouble. And, you know, that, but that excitement, though, is important. You know, we have that now. And I think there's a lesson to be learned. As we're, you know, again, people who are older who remember this stuff, that's what we really need to do. And one thing that I'm trying to figure out how to do in my little role in this is, you know, use those lessons to say, hey, look, this excitement that what we have with young people, let's not just put it to use to get somebody elected. Let's actually put it to use to build something that can be sustained, that can maintain itself and actually be a real threat to the orthodoxy. And I think that we'll probably have a little better shot at it for the simple reason that we've been down this road before. You know, I remember how the evangelicals got corrupted, how the old paleocons got sidelined by the neocons. The mistakes are still within the memory of people who are alive today and active. So that'll help. But I think also is that the left is crazier now than it was 30, 40 years ago. If you're a guy, you're a white guy working at Google right now, you're looking for a job because you're looking around saying, I am working with lunatics and I don't want to live this way. That's the difference. It's not I want a better job. It's I don't want to live this way. And that's the thing that's different now than it was 30 years ago when I was a young guy getting excited about politics. And we got to find a way to capitalize on that. And I'm not a political theorist, but I write a lot, so it's a topic that I've been kind of noodling over. And I'll throw my ideas out there over the coming months. But we certainly need lots of people thinking about this because it's a hard nut to crack. It's not an easy problem to solve.
Yeah, I agree. We cannot just sit around and wait for our enemies to undo themselves, which seems to be one of the sort of the more basic strategic genius of a lot of people. Let's wait for the collapse. Let's wait for the enemy to defeat himself. It's like, well, yeah, they are. I do rejoice every time they make a serious mistake, but I don't think that can be our strategy. We have to really apply our minds to how to defeat them and how to roll them back. And I like that term rollback, and I borrow that from the Cold War, most definitely. We need to end the cultural Cold War and start rolling back the cultural Marxists. We need to roll them up into a few tiny corners of the culture, just like, the hard Stalinist left is now rolled up into North Korea, and that's about it. We need to roll them up into some really marginal spot in our society where they're basically voiceless, powerless, and regarded as akin to child molesters and can only whisper their ideas in darknet forums for fear of being thought completely insane. That's a pleasant vision of the end game for me. But how to do that? How to do that? The positive things that we can do to bring that about. It's a huge mental effort to formulate that. So the more people thinking about it, obviously, the better off. The sooner we're going to make some progress there.
Well, fellowship counts for a lot too. There was some guy asked a question similar to this at AMREN, and I wish I would have an opportunity to answer it. It's fellowship counts for a lot. Knowing that you're not alone, knowing there's other people out there. There was a guy who introduced you to me. I called him the International Man of Mystery in one of my blog posts. But
right.
He introduced me to a lot of people, and we'll keep in touch. And there's other bloggers I've met there. We keep in touch now, and that makes this a little easier. And confidence means a lot. A good example of this: I had a woman from some liberal publication. I'm not even really sure what it was. It's some website. I think I'm sort of a feminist website. She contacted me and said, "Well, I'm doing a piece on, the racist or something, hate thinkers, and I have questions." And I said to her, "I said, look, I have a couple million words posted on my blog, and I have a search index. Just put some words in there and search and go find it for yourself." And she was surprised that I wasn't interested in having an interview with her. And I said, "Well, I'm not in your thing. I'm in my thing. And you want to get in my thing, that's fine. Read my blog. I'll list of places to go."
We have our own media now. Yeah. And one thing that I've learned over the years is just how complacent people in the mainstream are, people who read mainstream sites, and how lacking in intellectual curiosity they are. So, for instance, when we would get a link or a mention from some mainstream news site, I would rejoice, and I think, okay, here they come. All these people are going to start clicking the link in The Guardian and coming to Countercurrents. It made almost no difference whatsoever in our traffic because these people are so intellectually complacent. They don't want to look. Whereas if I would post the link on my website, I was pretty sure that they were getting more traffic from Countercurrents than I was getting from them. And at that point, I just thought, it just doesn't matter. I just don't care about mainstream publicity. It doesn't measurably increase my traffic. And I thought that that was kind of an interesting phenomenon. We have our own media. And it attracts intellectually curious people. and the mainstream media doesn't do that much to help us. Have you had any mainstream links and things like that? Have you had that experience? Or what has your experience been if you've been linked by the mainstream press?
Well, my rule, once I started getting some popularity and people started linking to me, I thought, well, geez, what if somebody contacts me and wants to do something? And I said, they need me more than I need them. And I'm just not going to do it. It's not worth my time. And, you know, one of the things that's always bugged me for my whole life is you watch alleged conservatives go on some super liberal show and get pilloried for an hour. And I always thought, why in the world would someone do something so dumb like that? What would possibly be the reason you think you're getting, you know, you're going on PBS or MSNBC? There's no one watching that's going to give you a fair hearing. You're just wasting your time and you're helping the enemy. And so I said, I'm not going to do any of this stuff. But I've actually had some people contact. A woman I was talking about, it was interesting in that her comment to me was afterwards, we went back and forth a couple of times. I just told her, look, I'm not going to waste my time with this. I have, you know, I think I have something close to 3 million words right now. This back then was a little longer, so maybe I was at 2 million words. And when I write on a lot of different subjects, so it's not as if you can't find something that you could pull out of there. And but one of her comments to me was, geez, you know, I don't really understand. You don't fit into a particular box. And that's your problem, lady. You're working in a world of just two boxes. There's the red team and there's the blue team. And I'm not on any of those teams. And I don't really care how you guys get along and how you work with each other. But the end of result was basically just blowing her off. But, I had somebody from Fox News, send inquiries to me, and I saw some links back, but I never could figure out where it was coming from. I had somebody from NBC, or claiming to be from NBC, but I just ignored that one and I never saw anything from it. So, I get most of my traffic is Facebook, and I don't have a Facebook presence. I'm not on Facebook. I get tons of hits from Facebook.
That's how I discovered you. And the reason I discovered you was that my writer and friend, James O'Meara, reads you constantly and is constantly finding stuff that you write quotable. So he's sharing links to your blog and sharing quotes from it. So that's how I discovered the Z blog.
Yeah, and I have done zero marketing of myself. I'm terrible at this, so I don't even try. And, you know, I have... On average, I have 100,000 unique readers a month, which is, you know, it's not a lot. I mean, it's not nothing either. You know, it's for given that it's sort of a boutique sort of a site. It's not terrible. I get most of my traffic from people who are open-minded. There's a guy who does, Doug Ross. He's like a news aggregator. And he aggregates all these sort of fringy people, left and right, Marxist, and, you know, but if you find something interesting, he puts a link to it. And there's people out there who go to, he must have a huge following. I get tons of traffic from him. But again, he's an open-minded guy. I wouldn't say he's on our team, but it seems like he's kind of on our team. But again, it's just one of those examples of there's a lot more of us out there than we realize. And Vox Day has posted links to me all the time. And these are guys who are, you know, his audience, I would say, are probably more people into the fantasy fiction, science fiction stuff. I don't know. Maybe Gamergate people. There's a subreddit that is basically just, I think, I'm not entirely sure what it is, if you want to. It's either anime or it's anime gaming. I've never been able to figure it out, but they link the crap out of to my site, and I get there's a lot of them too. You know, I can tell. I'll see thousands of things, and I realize it's coming from Reddit, and it's this sort of underground gamer community.
That's really interesting. So let's talk about the Jewish question. You've mentioned it a couple of times. What are your thoughts on that? This most vexed question in our community.
Yeah, you know, it's the one that. I don't write about it a lot, and people ask me why, and I always tell them that, well, it's the one in which you can be the most reckless with, and that's where you see a lot of reckless people on Twitter, particularly. You know, you see guys who Jennifer Rubin writes something derogatory about white people, and they'll fill up her Twitter feed with pictures of ovens. Well, you know, you're not winning any hearts and minds with that stuff. And I get why people do it. You know, once it's kind of like the opposite of people who quit smoking become evangelists for quitting smoking. Well, people who quit the sort of progressive mindset become over the top in some cases about breaking the taboos of the left. And of course, that's the ultimate taboo. So they go bonkers with it. And I get that. And there's a lot of signaling there. You know, I've compared it, you know, I've compared our thing to being in a motorcycle club. I have a fair amount of familiarity with 1% bikers. And there's a lot of signaling that goes on in that world. Same in prisons. There's lots of signaling. And this is something that our thing does. And I get all that. But I don't want my comment section filled up with that crap. You know, I have a good comment section. I have smart readers. I have smart commenters. Oftentimes the comments on my posts are better than my posts. And, you know, when you have people who are in our team undercover working in universities, they want to be able to read this stuff in their office. And there's certain things I just can't tolerate in order to make sure that that happens. So I stay away from it in a writing thing, not because I don't have opinions on it. It's that it draws the wrong crowd. And so I made that decision a while back. But my honest opinion, it's one of those hard ones for me because I'm in the Jerry Taylor camp. You look white to me. I mean, I've known El Norte Mexicans, you know, in Texas, whose families were there, you know, in the 18th century. They look white to me. They have all the same opinions I do, including about my immigration and about Mexicans. It's hard to say that you're not in the club when you tick all the boxes except one. And I know conservative Jews who fall into that. I met some at Amran who they agree with me on everything. The difference being is that they're more than willing to have honest conversations about the roles of Ashkenazi Jews in America and what's wrong with Jews. That they, you know, they'll give you they'll chew your ear off about liberal Jews and their you know their problems. But I understand a lot of people in our thing say no, white is it's white Christian is really where they're coming from or Christian heritage. I know a guy who says it's only west of the Hajnal line, and given that I'm Russian, it means I'm technically a person of color in his view. So it gets to be complicated. But my honest opinion is that I think this thing works itself out in the end. Because I think Jews are having some of these conversations that we have about ethnicity and the realities of multiculturalism and the realities of race as it applies to the changing world. We're no longer going to be in a world where whites are a majority in many places and are under threat from rising tides of minority populations, sub-Saharan Africans, for example. But my hunch is that what happens in the end is that a lot of our folks, a lot of white people will never join our thing. They just can't. They'll commit suicide first. They'll throw themselves off a building before they'll do this. They can't imagine giving up their religion. And I think a lot of Jews will be like that too. But I think some portion of them will not, but maybe form their own thing, you know, that is kind of allied. You know what I mean? They just sort of, hey, we're not in this white, pro-white world, but we're not opposed to it either. We've got our own thing over here. You know, give us New Jersey and we'll make that, you know, our thing. But I think it'll work itself out. So I don't toss and turn about over that much. I understand all the arguments on both sides. My own view is I like talking to people. I can talk to anybody. I'll talk about just about anything. So I enjoyed, you know, at Amran talking to conservative Jews about Ashkenazi IQ and how that impacts culture. I'm less, I don't know what the right word is. My purity spiral stops somewhere below, above where other people's go.
That's interesting. I met a couple of Jewish individuals. I had some good conversations at Amran. They were quite red-pilled about the Jewish question themselves. Well, the way I put it with one guy is I said, look, when I was an undergraduate, I had a professor. He was my favorite professor. He's a political theory professor who was also a Tibetan Buddhist, and he did a seminar about Tibetan Buddhism and politics, and the last half of it was basically about the horrible plight of the Tibetans after the Chinese took over their country. And I became very emotionally invested with the Tibetan cause, but I'm not Tibetan. You know, I care about tigers and whales and other endangered species, but I'm not a tiger or a whale. And it's perfectly possible for people who aren't white or white European or white nationalist candidates, ethno-state citizenship candidates, to still be passionately attached to our cause because they think there's something horribly unjust about what's happening to white people. And it truly is the most monstrous crime in history, in my opinion, what's happening to our race. It's truly monstrous. And we win if we have more people fighting on our side and fewer people fighting against us. And that means two things. It means first, we try and get as many of our people on our side, but also it means that we try and get more allies. And if we can split enemy camps, if we can split off sympathizers and allies from enemy camps, that makes us stronger. It makes it more likely for us to win. So my attitude is, on the us versus them question, I want to be really strict on this, but at the same time, I don't have to sweat that because I realize there's a difference between people who are us and people who aren't us, but they're our allies. And they're people that I can respect and like and treasure because they actually do us a lot of good. Fine, but they're not us. And the "they look white to me" thing, that's a bridge too far. Yeah, they do look white. A lot of Jews look white. They exploit that ambiguity, though. They're white when it suits them, and they're not white when it suits them. And we have to stop letting them have it both ways.
That's an interesting point, though. I know a conservative Jewish guy who he takes it from the other direction. He says he hates the fact that his fellow Jews do that. And his argument is this. He goes, I'm fully support a white majority exercising its majority and aggressively exercising its majority. But I'm not a white person. I'm Jewish. And he hates that Jews don't understand that. It bugs him. And his view of it is that, you know, given the choices, you know, if the only place the Jews are going to be a majority is in Israel. If you're going to live outside of Israel, then you got to figure out some way to make it work with the majority and support that majority, understanding that, well, you're not going to be a part of the majority. That's not an unreasonable position to take. And that's what always comes back to me, is that I have a sense that that's probably where things will end up. A lot of conservative Jews will simply say, hey, we can't be a part of this thing, but it's good for us to support it because, given all the other options, that's the one that'll work out the best for us. And that it's a problem that solves itself. But at the same time, my problem with people who spend so much time on the JQ is simply that it's not the fight to have now. We have other fights. Our number one fight right now is getting people to join, not running people off. Our number one job is getting people to join. You know, like when that room has got when Amron is being held at a 5,000 seat arena, then maybe we can start talking about who we're going to not let in through the door. But we're nowhere near that yet. And I'm not going to waste a lot of mental energy worrying about how we're going to have our own version of the brown paper bag test when I may not live to see it. You know, there's a lot. This is a long fight. This is not something that's going to happen quickly. This is a long struggle. And, I've compared it to the Indians overthrowing the British Raj, or the Irish overthrowing the British, eventually just wearing them down. That's more like this is like. We have to think of ourselves as having been colonized by these weird pod people who look like us in some ways. They act like us in some ways, but they're not us. And they're slowly trying to destroy us. And that's the fight. This is the eternal fight. And it's going to be a long fight. And the big goals now are getting people woken up. I mean, that's the hardest part. I'm surprised, even at Ameren, there were some people there who freaked out over certain issues. You know, the JQ, of course, was one, but even a race issue. I brought up some stories about Baltimore, and this guy, you could see he's getting squeamish. I'm thinking, what in the hell are you here for, pal? But he's been trained his whole life. He's conditioned. And and getting past that flinch is really, really hard. And we have to appreciate that. You know, you've been at this a lot longer than I have. And I've told, you know, some of my readers, you have to appreciate the fact that people who are just waking up today, they're not completely woke. They're just waking up. You know, give them some time.
Oh, yeah. There was a time in my life, it was a long time ago now, but there was a time in my life when it took an act of courage, when I would actually have to work on my gut a little bit to just go to websites that talked about un-PC topics. And the fact that our movement is growing so dramatically right now means that there are many, many people who are in that position. And I always implore people who are more radical today to think about the time when they were in that position and have a little bit of compassion, for God's sake, for people who are dipping their toe in, exploring a little bit, even in the privacy of their own bedroom or their own apartment. They're still engaged in an act of courage, and it takes an even greater act of courage to take that offline and meet people in the real world. And that's where we come back to Ameren. A lot of people there were not only at their first Ameren conference, they were at their first real-world meetup of any kind with our people, and I thought Ameren was a great introduction to our cause for them, but it took an act of courage, and we need to simply be sensitive to that fact. We need to applaud them and encourage them more and try and bring them along. That's, I think, the great battle for us is moral, and it's not just moral principles, but it's morale. It's rousing up a fighting spirit. It's rousing up confidence. It's rousing up a sense of us versus them and getting us to actually take our own side rather than take their side, which we've been trained to do for so very long. So, I do agree, we should look at this with analogies from history. This could be a very long struggle. It could be like the Reconquista in Spain. That was a very long struggle.
That's why, if you look at my site, there's a couple things, and people, some of my readers have figured this out, is that I do use a little bit of, you know, humor, and I'm not, you know, a natural funny man, but I can make people laugh on occasion. And I sprinkle in lighter topics. I cover broad different stuff. I'll do sports, movies, TV, you know, any kind of stuff. And but the reason is that, you know, I've joked around, you know, I'm kind of like a delousing station. You come to a site like mine because your red-pilled friend sent you a link. And he sent you a link on something I wrote because he knew that you would read it and you wouldn't be upset or offended, but it would make you, you know, dissident right curious. And it kind of gets you thinking, you know, and so my role is to kind of let you know that, hey, you know, look at the comment people. They're all smart. There's I have guys who comment on my post who, you know, who speak multiple languages, live in other countries, they're college professors, they're academics. And you that normie guy looks at this and goes, hey, you know, these guys aren't a bunch of skinheads and, you know, they're wearing old Nazi uniforms. They're really smart and they're funny and they got all kinds of, you know, cool things going on. And so they start to lose that stink of the normal world. They start to feel comfortable taking off those clothes, you know. And, you know, somebody's got to be the ferryman. Somebody's got to be the guy who takes you over the River Styx and drops you off on the other side. I can't go with you after that. The journey after that is yours. But somebody's got to be that guy. And that's a role I can play. And so there's that. It means that there's certain topics I do dance around. I've told people that before. The JQ is a pretty good example. I don't spend a lot of time on it. I don't get real deep in the weeds on some other social issues because abortion would be a good example. There are people even to this day that just sets off alarm bells. But I do target certain audiences. I write a lot about the lunacy of libertarians. I write a lot about religion, and, you know, a fair number of active Christians are starting to move our way. And that's an important thing because a lot of them started moving to the left, particularly younger Christians. And being an alternative out there, I think, is important. So we all have a role to play, but it's the number one job is to grow the thing, you know, get it bigger. And I got to tell you, me writing about Amran and some of the other people, the excitement, Audacious Epigone, I don't know if you read his blog. He's more of a quantitative guy. His excitement on it, you could tell that excitement got other people excited. I'm kind of curious to see how many people have already signed up for VDare's event in the spring.
Yeah, I'm going to try and go to that, even though it's way expensive. I'm definitely going to try and be there. There are people I want to meet, like Sailor and Unz, for instance.
Yes. Yeah, I've already signed up. So so did some of the other people that were Amran. You know, they got home, they saw it, and said, you know what, this I'm not going to miss this. But you know, that's great, and hopefully it's a big turnout like Amran was, because that'll kind of further reinforce the fact that this is, you know, something's happening.
Definitely something's happening. Well, Z-Man, thank you so much. I really like the metaphor of the ferryman, and I'm going to spend a lot more time in your boat, and I hope a lot of my readers and listeners will be doing so as well. So let's make this just the first conversation of many, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a good time. I really enjoyed it, and it was a pleasure meeting you, and it's a pleasure getting to know you.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Greg.